Hey, Pittsburgh. Welcome to Trib Lives from the Newsroom, our podcast bringing you top stories from triblive.com. Almost 80 years ago, amid the Second World War, scientists like Niels Bohr and Barnes Wallis were part of the teams that created advancements that secured the victory of the Allied powers. One scientist, J. Robert Oppenheimer, has recently gotten a boost of renown due to the 2023 blockbuster film with his surname as the title. The film recounts Oppenheimer's path to his most well-known accomplishment, the creation of the atomic bomb, a creation that, like Dr. Frankenstein, Oppenheimer would later come to despise and regret, though his misgivings about the bomb were overshadowed by the end of the war. Some Pittsburghers may be surprised to learn that Oppenheimer and the Atomic Age have a few Pittsburgh ties. In fact, Aspinwall holds the childhood home of the great physicist's wife, Catherine Kitty Oppenheimer. Here to talk to me about these ties and do an author reading of a special Trib Live feature story is news editor Jonathan D. Silver. Hi, John.
Hey, Zach. Great to be here.
So, can you tell me what started you on this course to find Pittsburgh's ties to the Atomic Age and Oppenheimer?
Absolutely. This emerged from a brainstorming session that editors Rob Amon and Ben Schmidt and I had last late summer, early fall, when Oppenheimer was in theaters and was clearly going to be a blockbuster. And we were picking through a lot of ideas as to how we could connect the movie and the success of the movie to our area. And we knew certainly there must be some kind of connection or connections in our region to the Atomic Age. So I started doing some research and went through a lot of dead ends and then had a wonderful discovery about Kitty Oppenheimer having local ties.
Great. Now, what was this curation and journalistic process like for a story like this?
A lot of Googling, for one thing. Can't be overstated just how amazing it is to be able to log onto a computer and type in Pittsburgh Atomic Age and find all sorts of connections. So Google was very helpful, and that's how I came up with the Kitty Oppenheimer connection. There's very, very little written about it, but an incredible resource was the Heinz History Center. They have archives and archivists that are phenomenally helpful. And I have to give a special shout out to Leslie Pritzbillick and Margaret Hewitt over there. Those two helped me immensely. And also taking the time to read American Prometheus, the very long but very wonderful book and biography of Oppenheimer that the movie is based on. And then, of course, seeing the movie on the Trib's Dime, which is really nice as part of my research.
We're about to have you do an author reading of the story. Can you tell us some of the ties we're about to hear in your reading?
Absolutely. As we just mentioned, first and foremost, is the fact that Kitty Oppenheimer, Robert Oppenheimer's wife, grew up in Aspinwall. She was born in Germany, but spent her formative years right here in the Pittsburgh area, even graduating from Aspinwall High School. And her marriage certificate is on file in downtown Pittsburgh here. And her father bought a lot of land in the Aspinwall, O'Hara area. So there was a lot to mine as far as genealogical records and public records about that time in her life. The second big tie is involves a Pittsburgh company called the Eichle Engineering Corporation, which basically made its name by moving incredibly large and heavy objects like entire buildings and the huge pipes used to build the Hoover Dam. And they were contracted to figure out a way to move a 200-ton metal canister that was supposed to contain the gadget, which was the test bomb that was exploded in the New Mexico desert. It features prominently in the movie Oppenheimer, but they had to figure out how to move this incredibly heavy object to the test site, the Trinity test site in New Mexico. And then the third component of the story features a West Deer property and the former owners of that property, who Edgar and Marion Kratz, who were very heavily active in civil defense drills and protecting against nuclear fallout. And Edgar Kratz actually built his own bomb shelter in his backyard. And we went to go tour that. And it was a really crazy experience.
Very interesting. Well, I know I'm definitely looking forward to hearing the story. And I'm sure our listeners are too.
Thank you so much, Zach.
Okay, let's get into it.
J. Robert Oppenheimer's brilliant mind belonged to the atom, his loyalty to the United States, his passion to the New Mexico desert. But the beating heart of the American Prometheus belonged to a woman who grew up in Aspinwall. Yes, Aspinwall, childhood home of the great physicist's wife, Catherine Kitty Oppenheimer. Who could have imagined that the life story of the so-called father of the atomic bomb would be inextricably linked to this placid Pittsburgh suburb, even if only by marriage? Of all the places in the world, are you kidding me? Said Dan Martone, the borough engineer. Viewers of this summer's movie blockbuster, Oppenheimer, could be forgiven for not knowing the connection. The borough isn't mentioned in the three-hour opus that tracks the theoretical physicist's frantic race to build the atomic bomb and his fall from grace amid accusations during the 1950s Red Scare that he was a security hazard because of his past communist associations. No plaque marks Kitty's childhood home. Actress Emily Blunt, who plays Oppenheimer's complicated, polarizing, and strong-willed wife, doesn't make any reference to her Pittsburgh-area past. And even the FBI file on Kitty misidentified where she spent her youth as Aspinwald. One would have to mine dusty, decades-old records. A marriage license for Kitty and her first husband at the Allegheny County Courthouse, land records at the county office building in downtown Pittsburgh, a photograph of the Aspinwall High School class of 1928 in the basement of the borough building, to turn up anything indicating that the Pittsburgh area fell, by association, within Robert Oppenheimer's orbit. Or you could just read the original source material for the movie, the tome American Prometheus, to find a passing reference to Aspinwall, tucked into page 155. The nexus between Pennsylvania and one of the most critical figures of the nuclear era has remained obscure to all but the most diligent scholars, little appreciated and for the most part lost to time. While some of the region's links to the dawn of the atomic age stood in plain view, Westinghouse, for instance, built the world's first commercial nuclear power plant and shipping port, and designed the reactor for the first nuclear submarine, others were invisible, like gravity. The promise and peril of the power of the atom cast long shadows over Pennsylvania. They stretched from Forest Hills, home of the now-toppled Westinghouse atom smasher, to Shippingport. From Pittsburgh, original home of the Eichley Engineering Corporation, to the remote New Mexican desert, where Eichley workers transported a 214-ton metal canister nicknamed Jumbo to the atom bomb test site codenamed Trinity. From Aspinwall to West Deer, where the Kratz family constructed a backyard nuclear fallout shelter and amassed an impressive collection of atomic age ephemera. Throughout western Pennsylvania, scientists labored to unlock the mysteries of the quantum universe. Engineers harnessed the atom's energy, and families learned to fear a nightmare scenario of annihilation in a radioactive mushroom cloud. And in tiny Aspinwall, a little girl who was born in Germany could not possibly conceive that one day she would occupy a front row seat to history. For years, Kitty Oppenheimer stood by her world-famous husband. She sweated it out in Los Alamos, endured his devotion to former lover Gene Tatlock, grappled with her own problems with alcohol, and stuck up for him in 1954 when the U.S. government turned on him, humiliating Oppenheimer and declaring him a security hazard. Kai Bird, who, with Martin J. Sherwin, co-authored the Pulitzer Prize-winning American Prometheus, the book on which the movie is based, described her as complex and mercurial. Kitty is a very central figure in Oppenheimer's life. She was quite a colorful character in her own right, Bird told the Tribune Review. She comes across as a very strong personality and a little tortured with her own ambitions. I mean tortured, because she ended up going to Los Alamos and being the wife and mother and found those roles to be limiting and tough for her to carry out. Born Catherine Puning, Kitty made her entrance to the world in August 1910. The daughter of Franz Puning and the former Kathy Vissering, she spent her infancy in Germany's North Rhine-Westphalia state. In 1912, Franz set out alone for the U.S. to seek his fortune while in his early 30s. Standing 5 feet 6 inches with brown hair and brown eyes, Franz would have made the passage in less than a fortnight on the ocean liner SS Kaiser Wilhelm der Grosse, named after Germany's first emperor. Franz's wife and blue-eyed daughter would steam across the Atlantic and join him the next year. Franz had already tasted success, according to Shirley Straczynski and Patricia Klaus, authors of An Atomic Love Story, a book about Oppenheimer and three women, including Kitty, who loved him. He had invented a new type of blast furnace, they wrote, quote, which he felt would be in demand in the Iron Belt of the United States. For a time, Franz worked as a chemical engineer in Chicago. But in 1921, a year before Oppenheimer enrolled at Harvard, his future father-in-law surfaced in Allegheny County. That year, Puning made the first of numerous land purchases in O'Hara. His buying spree would last until 1928. Deed books at the county office building show 7 discrete transactions by Herr Puning of lots on and near Delafield Road. Prices range from $600 to $4,000, or between about $10,000 and $70,000 today. What prompted Puning to leave Chicago for Allegheny County is unknown, but by 1922, Puning made it clear that he was in the U.S. to stay, becoming a naturalized citizen at Pittsburgh's federal courthouse, then at 4th Avenue and Smithfield Street. A contemporary city directory listed him as a chemical engineer with Copper's Company and living in Aspinwall. By then, the family was well integrated into Pittsburgh cultural circles. That year, one of the Puning women, likely Kitty, took part in a piano recital of junior students of the Pittsburgh Musical Institute on Bellafield Avenue. A June 7, 1922 edition of the Pitt Weekly listed the performers. Among them, Catherine Puning, playing the cheerful Elfin Dance by German composer Adolf Jensen. Kitty's mother had high aspirations for her daughter. Even if the Punings didn't socialize with the Carnegies, Fricks, or Mellons in Pittsburgh, Kathy would see to it that her only child would know how to navigate in their world, according to An Atomic Love Story. Kitty became a proficient horseback rider, the authors wrote, noting that Aspinwall had its own riding trails. Years later, this skill would help enthrall Oppenheimer, himself an excellent horseman, as they rode through the Sangre de Cristo Mountains in New Mexico. While the Punings provided their only child with a comfortable upbringing in Aspinwall, all was not easy. As German immigrants, they wrote, the Punings sometimes had a difficult time in Pittsburgh during World War I. As an enemy alien, Franz Puning was placed under surveillance by local authorities, and even young Kitty had a hard time with neighborhood kids. Kitty had to learn English in America. By the time she was a teenager, her spirited streak was on display with her classmates. She was wild as hell in high school, a friend of Kitty's told Bird and Sherwin. Kitty and her family lived on Delafield Road through the 1920s. Their capacious home became what authors Straczynski and Klaus called the headquarters for the circle that revolved around Kitty. She was bright, outspoken, daring, they wrote, and attractive to men. A high school boyfriend described her as intellectually superior and said that she had moved decidedly to the political left in her senior year. By 1930, census records show, the Punings had moved to Hampton Road in O'Hara, a short street which is today part of Fox Chapel. The census doesn't reflect a street number, so it's not clear whether the Hampton Road house still exists. But clearly, Kitty's family was doing well. The home, which the family owned, was valued at $26,000, nearly $500,000 today, and the Punings had a servant, a young woman newly arrived from Germany. In 1928, right after graduation from Aspinwall High School, Kitty enrolled at the University of Pittsburgh. She wouldn't complete her degree there, though. Instead, wrote Bird and Sherwin, Kitty embarked on a checkered college career, returning to Europe to study in Germany and France, but mostly spending time as a flaneuse lounging in Parisian cafes. She would eventually find her way back to the U.S. educational system, graduating with honors in 1939 from the University of Pittsburgh as a botany major. One notable event took place in that period of Kitty's life. She acquired a husband. On Christmas Eve in 1932, Kitty applied for a marriage license in Allegheny County with Frank W. Ramsire, a musician and Boston native 5 years her senior. They were wed 2 days later, but Bird and Sherwin say that the marriage, which they described as impulsive, quickly soured. Several months into the marriage, Kitty found her husband's diary. He kept it in mirror writing and learned that he was both a drug addict and a homosexual, they wrote. Before a year was out, according to the authors, Kitty began studying biology at the University of Wisconsin, and the marriage was annulled in that state. But romance for Kitty would soon blossom again in Pittsburgh. 10 days after the annulment, according to the authors, Kitty was home for a New Year's Eve party when she met Joe Dallet, a sophisticated German-Jewish communist who could play piano and speak fluent French. Despite a privileged upbringing, Dallet abandoned his moneyed roots and worked blue-collar jobs as a longshoreman, coal miner, and union organizer following his political awakening, Bird and Sherwin wrote. Kitty fell in love with him. They married 6 weeks later, and Kitty joined him in Youngstown, Ohio. It didn't take long before she was handing out communist literature on the streets of Youngstown, according to the authors. But by the end of 1937, Kitty was a war widow. Dallet had gone to Spain to fight the fascists during the Spanish Civil War and was killed in battle. The Punings had moved to London, according to an Atomic Love story. Aspinwall was no longer home. Fast forward 2 years to a garden party in Pasadena, California, a world away from Aspinwall. It was there that Kitty, 29, first laid eyes on Robert Oppenheimer. The physicist had just broken up with Gene Tatlock, his troubled occasional lover, portrayed on screen by actress Florence Pugh. And Kitty? She was unhappily married to her third husband, a British physician named Richard Harrison, who had moved to Pasadena to practice medicine. Armed with her botany degree from the University of Pennsylvania, Kitty followed him. When Kitty met Oppenheimer, she was immediately mesmerized, wrote Bird and Sherwin. Their affair began soon after. She was very attractive, a physician who taught at Berkeley told the authors. She was tiny, skinny as a rail, just like Oppenheimer was. They'd give each other a fond kiss and go their separate ways. Robert always had that pork pie hat on. Bird and Sherwin described Kitty as petite, attractive, and vivacious. The botany major cultivated orchids, they wrote. Straczynski and Klaus painted this portrait of Kitty. Small and vivid, not beautiful in any usual way, but engaging and confident. Her eyes were dark and expressive, and she laughed easily. There was nothing coy or timid about her. She was the kind of woman whose appeal could never be explained by a photograph. After spending 2 months with Oppenheimer at his New Mexico ranch in 1940, the physicist himself telephoned her husband to break some big news in what would have been an awkward conversation for most people. Kitty was pregnant. That November, the Oppenheimers were married. Robert would become Kitty's last husband, and Kitty would become the revered scientist's one and only wife. She was a sort of mercurial personality, and mercurial in her relationship with Oppenheimer. She was obviously quite devoted to him and in love, Bird said. Likewise, Oppenheimer stuck by her all those decades till the day he died. She could be a trial. In the movie, Blunt portrays Kitty, a one-time communist, as sharp-tongued, intelligent, and staunch in defending Oppenheimer against the government's attacks in 1954. We make a point of describing her role in the trial as an extraordinary performance where Oppenheimer himself seems passive and unable to defend himself, Bird said. Kitty is just the opposite and is able to parry the questions of the prosecutor and to make fun of them and to deflect his interrogation. And she did it with wit. It was further evidence of how clever a woman she was. Now, nearly a century after Kitty graduated from Aspinwall High School, Martone, the borough engineer, has become fascinated by her story. He's made a point of trying to track down her childhood home and believes that once he does, it should be memorialized. Bird believes that Kitty would be a worthwhile figure to remember. He noted that Kitty cut an unusual path for a woman in the 1930s, traveling all over Europe, joining the Communist Party, and shrugging off the trappings of her upbringing. Opinionated, ambitious, and steadfast, Kitty was an early feminist, desired a career, and likely struggled through postpartum depression, according to the author. Though she grew up in privileged circumstances in Pittsburgh, she went to Youngstown, Ohio with her new husband, Joe Dallet, spent 4 years living in very straitened circumstances, passing out leaflets at factory doors, Bird said. She was an incredibly passionate figure and, I should think, an interesting role model for women today. On February 10th, 1945, with the Oppenheimers living in Los Alamos and the Manhattan Project in full swing, a branch of the U.S. War Department drafted a document that would forever link a Pittsburgh company to the covert effort to build the atom bomb. Stamped secret, the typed title was deliberately vague. Specifications for transporting and placing government-owned vessel. Whichever cautious military men dreamed up that heading wanted to shroud the project's true purpose. The vessel was a 214-ton metal canister nicknamed Jumbo. As heavy as a blue whale, it measured almost 27 feet long, about 12 feet in diameter, and had steel walls more than 15 inches thick. The Army was looking for a company to do something it couldn't. Move the thermos-shaped unit about 30 miles across unpaved desert to a site known as Trinity. Enter the Eichley Engineering Corp. of Pittsburgh. A family-run enterprise, Eichley specialized in transporting incredibly heavy objects. Entire office buildings, the gargantuan pipes installed in the Hoover Dam, and the whole of St. Nicholas Church in Oakland, to name a few. In 1926, according to the House Movers, a company history written by John W. Eichley Jr., the founder's great-grandson, Eichley's chief engineer summed up his team's can-do spirit this way: "They don't build them too big for us to move." Nearly 20 years later, Eichley once again proved that motto to be true. So, what was Jumbo? To understand, one first needs to appreciate the immense challenge facing Manhattan Project scientists in creating weapons-grade plutonium and uranium in sufficient quantities to power a bomb. Oppenheimer cleverly captured this painful creep of production. Actor Cillian Murphy, portraying the theoretical physicist, is shown month after month dropping marbles into glass bowls, representing the excruciatingly slow refinement of the critical radioactive isotopes. Eventually, the bowls were filled, and America had its nuclear catalyst. As Los Alamos engineer Jonathan Morgan put it in a 2021 paper for the journal Nuclear Technology, the extremely limited supply of plutonium made gold look rather pedestrian. So incredibly valuable to the U.S. war effort was the plutonium, Morgan wrote, that concern was raised about the possibility of wasting the precious plutonium in a fizzle or dud. The bomb at Trinity was meant to be detonated through two explosions. First, TNT, followed a fraction of a second later by the nuclear material. The scientists were sure the TNT would explode, but were initially unsure of the plutonium, according to the U.S. Army. If the chain reaction failed to occur, the TNT would blow the very rare and dangerous plutonium all over the countryside. And so was born the idea for Jumbo, a huge metal can to hold the test bomb, codenamed Gadget, and allow the isotopes to be salvaged if the weapon flopped. The physicists were afraid that if the reaction did not go the way they hoped it would, an enormous explosion, that they would lose all this material, and that would put the whole race to have a super bomb back months, if not years, Eichley, 77, of Shadyside, said. So this thing was sort of a fail-safe mechanism that they could retrieve the valuable radioactive material if it didn't work. Just as scientists and engineers were in uncharted territory trying to build a nuclear bomb, they were also pioneering a way to contain the massive TNT blast. First, they considered a huge steel sphere. Only three companies in the U.S. could make such a unit, according to Morgan. All were in Pennsylvania: General Engineering and Foundry Co., and Jones and Lachlan in Pittsburgh, and Bethlehem Steel. But various concerns led Oppenheimer to reconsider that design. Eventually, they settled on what became Jumbo. Tapped to build it? Babcock and Wilcox, an Akron area company. Babcock and Wilcox had no idea what Jumbo was for. Neither did Eichley, nor any of the other Pittsburgh-area companies working in ignorance on different facets of the war effort, according to Leslie Prisbillick, senior curator at the Senator John Hines History Center. No one knew what they were doing, Prisbilik said. They were only told so much. It's not surprising that Western Pennsylvania played a role. Not only was Pittsburgh a research and technology hub with Westinghouse, Mellon Institute, and Carnegie Tech, but the region also had companies that turned out electronic equipment, scientific instruments, precision metal parts, and enamel components. A trucking firm, W.J. Dillner Transfer Co., was the sole hauler of bomb materials from Westinghouse to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where scientists were enriching uranium, according to Prisbilik. Secrecy was paramount. Top brass in the military wanted to compartmentalize information to make sure one hand didn't know what the other was doing. In Oppenheimer, Matt Damon plays General Leslie R. Groves, the ultra-cautious impresario of the Manhattan Project. Groves feared that randomly dropped phrases, bits of knowledge, and names or places might fall into the hands of some centralized enemy spy network, where it might then enable reconstruction of the project, according to the Atomic Heritage Foundation. So paramount was security in building Jumbo that the government used obscure procurement methods so that items could not be traced back to the project, Morgan wrote. To underscore the secrecy of the project, the first page of the War Department proposal warned that anyone who publicized the information it contained could be prosecuted as disloyal to the U.S. war effort under the Espionage Act. It was difficult to manage a crew from Pittsburgh in the desert, with the nearest civilization outside of the Los Alamos base 35 miles away in Socorro, New Mexico, according to Eichley. They knew this was a big war effort, but they didn't know what they were doing, he said. They'd work hard in the desert all day and go into Socorro or someplace like that and knock back beers and talk about what they were doing in this hellhole, this hot place. But people were listening. The people they would be talking to would be FBI agents, Eichley said. Dad had a hard time maintaining the crew. They lost about three or four of them because of their loose lips. Chatterboxes would be put on the next train back to Pittsburgh, he said. Pennsylvania continued to play a central role in Jumbo's construction, according to Morgan. Midvale Steel Corp. in Philadelphia contributed a key nozzle, and when only partially completed, the entire unit was shipped to Mesta Machine Co. in West Homestead to be worked on a large lathe. Once Jumbo was finished, it needed to be moved. The Army was on a strict timetable. It wanted the task finished by June 15, 1945. It soon became clear why. 1 month and 1 day later, the world's first atomic bomb was successfully detonated at the White Sands Missile Range. A Mercer County manufacturer of railroad equipment, Greenville Steel Car Company, made the rail car used to take Jumbo from Ohio to the desert, Morgan wrote. The next step? Hauling it from the railroad siding in Pope, New Mexico to Trinity. Babcock and Wilcox suggested Eichley, whose experience moving the Hoover Dam pipes had prepared it for Jumbo. An Erie County company, Rogers Brothers Corporation, built the 64-wheel chassis that was used. Tractors were hooked up to the trailer, and the contraption towed Jumbo across the white gypsum sand dunes of the Chihuahuan Desert. But by then, after all that time, effort, and money, the scientists had decided they weren't going to use Jumbo after all. Morgan noted that although major concerns about the gadget lingered mere days before the Trinity test, the scientists, months earlier, had ruled out encasing the bomb, worried that doing so would block access to critical test data if the nuclear explosion worked. That created a new problem. What was General Groves going to do with this enormous thermos bottle that they had paid tens of millions of dollars for, Eichley said. That was a lot of money back then. The solution? Rig it up in a giant steel tower a half mile away to see if it could withstand the blast. I think that's why my father was actually out on the site, Eichley said. This was a significant change order in the scope of their work, and he had to go out of here and talk to the Army engineers and get an idea what they wanted. So they hoisted Jumbo horizontally, flipped it to the vertical position, and lowered it back to the desert floor to await the detonation. Three observation points were set up, each 5.6 miles north, south, and west of Ground Zero, according to government records. Their code names? Abel, Baker, and Pittsburgh. Just before 5:30 a.m. on July 16th, 1945, Gadget exploded in a blinding white flash. Success. Heat like the sun flooded Trinity. Particles of desert sand fused into green glass. Windows broke 120 miles away. A mushroom cloud bloomed nearly 40,000 feet skyward. The tower that held the gadget was vaporized, and the one surrounding Jumbo was destroyed. But Jumbo survived, unscathed. The Big Jug soon came to an ignominious end. In 1946, 8 unusable 500-pound bombs were lowered into the canister. When the bombs exploded, they blew the ends off Jumbo. Despite surviving a nuclear blast, the steel container couldn't contend with less powerful explosives, since they were placed in the bottom of the unit, touching the vessel wall, not in the middle part, as per the design. Metal fragments whizzed through the air, landing nearly a mile away. Morgan theorized that Jumbo was used for unexploded ordnance to justify its construction in case auditors poked around on the $12 million project. What would these days be a $200 million boondoggle? Today, the remnants of Jumbo remain at the entrance to Ground Zero. And Eichle remains modest about the role his family company played in the war effort. To say that his father was part of the Manhattan Project, he said, would be gilding the lily. But when asked how he feels about the work that went into transporting Jumbo, Eichle summed it up with one word, pride. If anyone was prepared to survive a nuclear holocaust, it was Edgar Kratz. He knew that the first warning of incoming nukes might be the Civil Defense Alert Signal, a loud, steady blast for 3 to 5 minutes. That would cue Edgar and his wife Marion to spring into action. They would round up the girls, Bev and Millie, tune the AM radio to the Connell-Rad emergency broadcast system, and shut off appliances and utilities. Then they would wait, straining to hear the most chilling sound imaginable, the take cover signal, three short blasts shredding the air over 3 minutes. In that nightmare scenario, it would be time to go to the fallout shelter immediately. For the Kratzes, that would mean the shortest of trips. Safety was only as far as the backyard. They might have been one of the few families in West Deer in the 1950s, maybe one of the few in Western Pennsylvania, to have their own fallout shelter. Made of concrete block, slathered with tar and a poured concrete roof, the structure had a hand crank mechanism to draw in fresh air through a pipe topped with a mesh filter. The Kratz family fallout shelter was a sign of the times and the price of progress made by the Manhattan Project. Kratz, a crane operator at the old Pittsburgh Pipe and Coupling Company, had built the bunker into a hillside in West Deer, covering it with sod. He had constructed his house himself, so why not a sturdy refuge for his family? To enter the shelter today is a surreal experience. Or, as current homeowner Sean Koshik says, it's like entering a time capsule. The shelter's entrance is roughly 50 feet from the back of the house, hidden but for a black metal air pipe sticking up out of the ground. Dug into a hillock overlooking Deer Creek, the entrance is a weathered metal door set at an angle into the back of the hill. Big black spiders have made their homes in the dark, dank shelter, moist despite Kratz's attempt at waterproofing. A fragile set of 9 wooden steps, 8 now, since a contractor recently broke one while having a look around, descends roughly 7 feet into the darkness, bringing visitors to a hallway wide enough for only one person. A light switch and a bulb no longer work. Several paces down an oppressive 8-foot-long hallway, a left turn brings you into the cramped living quarters. It's roughly a square, 8 feet by 8 feet, and less than 7 feet tall. The single wooden bunk bed, the girls were warned that the family would have to sleep in shifts, has long since moldered, exposing 9 glass jugs on the floor that were meant to be the water supply. A crude chemical toilet is tucked into a corner with a pipe running from it. A few bottles of old cleaning supplies remain. Kratz's daughters don't know exactly how he got it in his head to build a fallout shelter. Maybe it was the war. Kratz served in the Navy during World War II. Though Bev Shirer, Kratz's eldest daughter, said her father never saw combat, he knew what the bomb could do. By the time he came home from the war, everyone did. The world now lived under the shadow of what Oppenheimer and his fellow scientists had created. He was always kind of a nervous fellow. He always bit his nails, recalled younger daughter Millie Sass, 76, of Pittsburgh's South Oakland neighborhood. I guess, seeing the war, he understood what war could bring and how disaster could be so much worse with more modern technology. In hindsight, decades later, the sisters valued his effort. I thought it was pretty neat to say you had a bomb shelter, and I appreciate that Dad thought enough of his family to protect them like that, even though I'm sure there was ridicule from everybody, said Shirer, 79, of Tittiute in Warren County. Shirer, born 2 years before the atom bomb was dropped, wasn't bothered by the shelter. She and her classmates were already doing civil defense drills in school, hiding under their desks. She felt relieved to know that if the unimaginable happened, she had somewhere to hide. They had nowhere to go, she said, and I had a bomb shelter. Mechanically inclined, Kratz could often be found sitting at the kitchen table, poring over the latest issue of the DIY magazine Popular Mechanics. Shirer thinks her father might have come across plans for a fallout shelter in one of the editions. The bunker would have fit right in with Kratz's concerns about a nuclear war and his meetings at Deer Creek Church with neighbors as part of the West Deer Township Survival Unit No. 2. They seem to be following the slogan, "Alert Today, Alive Tomorrow," popularized on posters distributed by the Federal Civil Defense Administration, established in 1951 under President Harry Truman. A typed piece of paper in Kratz's possession addressed his neighbors and made clear the stakes facing the group. "As you know, several men have been asked to form and prepare a survival unit in our immediate area, which has been done, and we have been in touch with you, encouraging you to be prepared," it stated. "It is our prayer that what we are asking you to consider may never have to be put into practice. However, in case of nuclear attack, it is our concern that this area be as well prepared as possible to meet such an emergency." The Kratzes did their part. Both husband and wife earned certificates by completing a 12-hour civil defense adult education course through the State Department of Public Instruction. Kratz stockpiled material about surviving atomic Armageddon. He had hand-drawn maps of West Deer showing area roads and marked with concentric circles and the locations of neighbors. He kept diagrams of typical atomic bomb bursts. He filed away charts of the effects of different levels of radiation exposure. No doctor on hand in the shelter? No problem. Just consult the booklet, Venipuncture and Intravenous Procedures. Need to know how to read your Geiger counter? Peruse the Handbook for Radiological Monitors. How about instructions on helping an infant take a first breath or cutting the umbilical cord? There was a document for that. Bomb-born babies. Whenever a catastrophe or a major disaster hits a civilian population, babies arrive in large numbers, prematurely, rapidly, and without much ceremony, it said. As he cries, hold him up where the mother can see him. Tell her, with all the enthusiasm you can muster, that he is a beautiful baby. Kratz also collected a wide array of guides. They were pamphlets of sober title, a compendium worthy of a library shelf. Family Food Stockpile for Survival, Soil, Crops, and Fallout from Nuclear Attack, Radioactive Fallout on the Farm, Before Disaster Strikes, What to Do Now About Emergency Sanitation at Home. A hard worker and inveterate perfectionist, Kratz would spend nights, weekends, even times when others would be at church, constructing his fallout shelter. Shirer remembers her father toiling. When Kratz poured a concrete slab, he let the family's two black cats, Ike and Mike, adorn it with their paw prints. He ran electricity to it from the house. It was tight in the shelter, no wasted space. Everything fit just right. You had a bucket at the foot of the beds with this kind of wall. I guess there was a curtain. That was your toilet, Shirer recalled. The girls weren't allowed to goof around down there. It was not a play place, Sass said. It was a serious endeavor. Having grown up with a shelter, the sisters didn't regard it as something unusual. It was just a part of their life. But they had questions and concerns. Coming from a big family all over the nearby farmland, the girls wondered What would happen to their favored cousins if an attack came? Could they save them? No, their father would say, according to Shirer. There can only be four people in there. That begged other questions. What about their two dogs? How would they get mattresses and food down there in an emergency since Kratz hadn't thoroughly stocked the shelter? And if bombs were dropped, how would they ward off neighbors desperate to save themselves? It wasn't a secret. I don't know how he thought he was going to keep everybody out and only let the four of us in. We did no drills. There were no guns or anything to protect ourselves, Shirer said. There was something else that gnawed at Shirer. I could never understand how we were going to be safe in there. How long would you have to be in there, she said. You couldn't have enough food in there to survive for more than a week, maybe. It never made any sense to me that you could live underground, and when you came out, everybody would be dead. Over the years, as the imminent menace faded, the Kratzes began using the shelter as a root cellar. Edgar Kratz died in 1985. A few years after Marion's death in 2012, Sass was cleaning out the house when she came across a big box in the basement rafters. It was still sealed. To her surprise, it contained two gas masks, a Geiger counter, and a dosimeter. She called the Heinz History Center. I think I have something you might be interested in, she told the museum.
Thanks again to Jonathan Silver, TribLive, and the Heinz History Center. For these and more stories, please visit TribLive.com. I'm Zach Gibson, and once again, this is From the Newsroom.
writing process and what are the main points whenever you're writing? Yep. So tell me about how you found the story.
Sure. This started coming together late summer, early fall, when Oppenheimer was in the movie theaters and it was really a big blockbuster. And we were sitting around, myself, I was a reporter at that point, and the managing editor, Rob Amon, and my just trying to brainstorm a little bit about what we could do with this Oppenheimer phenomenon. It was a huge thing in theaters, and ties between the Oppenheimer movie and Pittsburgh. And so that sort of started us on the path of trying to figure out what we would do. And I spent quite a while, several weeks probably, really poking around, just trying to find some links to the Atomic Age, that era in the 40s and then the 50s, where the Cold War hung over the country, about what we could do to kind of link Pittsburgh in the movie. And then I discovered a connection directly to Robert Oppenheimer.
Okay. So in the story,